This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with the former head of Jefferson County's Climate Action Committee about where his activism is leading, and a Port Townsend woman puts her fashion business on wheels. So now, let's go inside the Compass. With delegates from around the world meeting in Warsaw for the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, and with extreme weather events like the recent late-season tornadoes in the Midwest and Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines underscoring the urgency of the climate problem, I decided last week to go and have a talk with my friend Case Kolff about what he is personally planning to do next about the issue that has consumed much of his attention in recent years. As the chair of the committee that devised the climate action plan adopted by both the city and the county 2 years ago, Kolff is perhaps Port Townsend's most visible climate activist. Although he stepped down from that committee shortly after seeing the plan adopted, I knew that he'd remained active on the issue. So I'm just wondering, I mean, what are you doing around climate now?
Well, first, Steve, let me just comment that I think both the county and the city did the right thing when they adopted a goal of reducing our carbon emissions to 80% below the 1990 levels by the year 2050. And this is something which credible scientists say is required in order for us to really get a handle on climate change. Basically, my latest studying and activism in this area was triggered by a movie called Bitter 70 about Tim DeChristopher. It's about this young man who at age 27 in the year 2008 single-handedly completely disrupted the gas and lease auction to over 150,000 acres of pristine southern Utah wilderness. He and a number of friends were protesting outside of the auction hall. And somebody said, "Oh, are you here for the auction?" And he said, "Yes." And then they said, are you here to bid?" And he said, "I guess so." And they let him in and gave him a bidder card.
Number so he did 70. This without any sort of plan to do it?
No, he wasn't planning to do that at all. So he bid on thousands of acres. And when they realized that he had no intention of buying these leases, they ended the auction and basically charged him with a federal crime. And he insisted on having a jury trial and would not settle out of court for 30 days in jail. And ultimately, the jury trial was very disturbing to many people because the jury was ordered by the judge to ignore anything having to do with climate change, anything having to do with their conscience, anything other than did he break this particular law? And ultimately they said that he was guilty and he spent almost 2 years in prison. And he came out of prison and decided to go to the Harvard School of Divinity to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. And when asked by Bill Moyers, well, why not become a lawyer and try to change the laws and try to work at it that way? He basically said that he thought that there are lots of people in this country who are concerned about what's happening. What's needed is connecting people together in a way so that people will stand up for their moral conscience and their values, and he felt he could do that better from the pulpit than from a lawyer's desk. And we showed the movie at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We had some follow-up discussions, and out of that grew a number of people who said, well, what stance could we take that would be perhaps not get us to spend 2 years in prison, but that can we become more radical? At that same time, there was a national call by Credo Action and 350.org to resist the Keystone XL pipeline. And in fact, there are a growing number of people who have been arrested in protest to the interim steps that seem to imply that the State Department is not taking seriously the environmental impact of this proposed pipeline, which basically would allow Alberta, Canada, to ship an additional 500,000 barrels of tar sands, bitumen tar, all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico for essentially for export.
This is some of the dirtiest oil on the planet.
It really is. And if you see pictures of what's happening in Alberta, the way you take tar sands out of this, I mean, it's basically like strip mining or mountaintop removal, but you're basically removing the top 50 feet of just vast 100 feet of just huge areas and shipping it out. Not to mention that in order to get this very, very thick tar, basically, it's not oil. In order to get it to act anything like oil, you either have to heat it tremendously and you need to put some dissolvents in it, which are very toxic. And so their preferred method of shipping this out of Alberta is south through the heartland of the U.S., where there are groups that are resisting this, some of this additional pipeline development. But nationally, supposedly, there are over 70,000 people who have pledged some kind of resistance if the State Department and the administration allows this pipeline to go through. What that means, I'm not quite sure, you know, what the resistance means. But in preparation for that, and after seeing Tim DeChristopher's movie, we organized a training at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and 20 people came for an all-day training on how do you safely and peacefully resist something that's happening that our government is doing, and support those people who are willing to actually be arrested in protest. And we have a long history in this country of people doing this kind of protest. And in this community, we have a lot of people who have actually been arrested doing a variety of protests, some of them at on Indian Island. And there are safe ways to do it and peaceful ways to do it, and it makes a point. And so we have a number of people here who are now trained and willing and able to take protesting perhaps one step further. And we're waiting to hear whether the State Department decide this is in the national interest to do this. And then President Obama has, I believe, 90 days to actually make the final decision as to whether or not this is going to happen. And many of us think that it is not in keeping with his promise to deal with global warming. And at this training, there were a number of people who said that they're concerned, that they were actually more concerned about the coal trains planning to come.
I was going
to
ask about that, because that is sort of our local version of that, is the coal trains.
It is remarkable how many groups are beginning to realize the potential danger of the added export terminals here in the state of Washington. And in fact, just two nights ago, I was in Seattle at a forum that was sponsored by the Washington Environmental Council. And they had six people from respectable organizations give reports on what's happening. Sightline Institute, Earth Justice, Forest Ethics, Friends of the Earth, Friends of the San Juans, and the Washington Environmental Council all gave reports, and it is absolutely shocking what the cumulative effect would be of the different plans for expanding the ability to ship by rail coal and oil from the heartland of America to our coast, and then to have some of it refined by the refineries, but most of it shipped unrefined, because, in fact, if you add all the proposals together, it far outstrips the ability of our refineries to deal with it. The key thing that I found shocking is that if, in fact, all of these terminals that are being planned for different parts of Washington's coast, there are two of them proposed for Ferndale. There are two proposed up in Anacortes. There's one in Tacoma, Grays Harbor, Port Westward, Vancouver, Longview. I mean, these are all places where the ports are gearing up to expand their ability to accept trains. The first train carrying oil actually came through Washington State about a year ago. So this is a fairly new phenomenon. And they're planning to increase this to the point that if they all of these permits and all this development occurred, we would be shipping from the state of Washington almost 50% more oil than the Keystone XL pipeline. So we've got a problem right here, not in the form of a pipeline, but of train lines. And these trains are a mile and a half long. And perhaps you've heard about some of the disasters that have occurred in three different places that we know of, in Canada, and I think Alabama had one where these train cars derail, and because of the volatility of the contents, they explode.
There was a whole town destroyed in Canada, right?
Yeah, 46 people were killed. Yeah. If you look at the map, they showed some amazing maps of where this stuff is going, and most of it would be going through Spokane, where they would be proposing 35 trains per day. That's 53 miles of train coming through Spokane. And then most of it ends up going down along the Columbia River, but some of it up through into Tacoma. And then in order to get to Anacortes or north to Ferndale, it's got to go through Seattle. And the number of trains, currently apparently it's two trains per day that go through Seattle. And if these proposals go through, it would be 18 trains per day, 27 miles of trains going through. And most of that would be coal, but up to about a quarter of that is with oil.
Well, so now what kind of legal tools do we really have to stop this?
Well, first of all, all of these activities require permits, and I believe that the governor actually has the right to reject any of the permits for what's being proposed. And I'm not a lawyer on this. I believe the governor has a tremendous amount of power. Second of all, he did convene a group called the Climate Legislative and Executive Work Group, and their goal, I believe, is primarily to look at what needs to happen in order for the state to reach the targets that were set by law for our own greenhouse gas emissions reductions. And those targets aren't as strict as the targets we've set here in this county. It includes, by the year 2020, getting down to the 1990 levels in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. By the year 2035, getting 25% below the 1990 levels. And by the year 2050, 50% below the 1990 levels. Now, much of this pass-through of oil and coal could be argued, well, it's not really increasing our emissions because this stuff is just going through our state. And therefore, we shouldn't count the oil that's shipped to Asia as, on our bill of carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions. That's in part the argument that the Canadians and that the State Department has used so far, which is that this will create jobs and that's good, and we're not going to burn it, and so that's okay. And I think what many of us are saying is, no, that's not okay. We got to keep fossil fuels in the ground, thank you very much, and we should not be facilitating the shipment of this stuff through our state. However, I think the human health impact is a serious one. I think that is a perfectly valid reason to reject this increased transport and export. I think the environmental risks are enormous when you look at what happens with a spill and when you look at the number of ships, because all of this stuff gets to the port and it gets put on these tankers that also, have an enormous threat to our marine environment. You know?
Well, and those tankers burn bunker fuel, which is a very dirty source itself, and the trains run on diesel. And so, you know, there is there is a direct, we are burning more fuel in order to transport this.
Well, I do stand corrected. Clearly, this would end up producing more greenhouse gases in the state. And your reminder, it's one of these tankers, they carry a million gallons of bunker fuel in order to transport. And the size of these vessels are enormous. 10,000 large ships went through the Salish Sea in the year 2012. And if these proposals go in, that'll be increased by an additional 2,000 large ships. And I have a little graph here that shows the relative size of the oil tankers versus the Washington State ferries, and they're like 2.5 times as long and
three times as tall. Three times as tall, it looks like.
And then, no, that's the three times as tall. Those are the dry bulk carriers that carry coal. Oh. And these things are like five times as long as the Washington State ferries and three times as tall. And would end up exporting 48 million tons of coal annually from the Gateway Pacific Terminal near Bellingham. And so, again, thinking of our proximity here to the Straits of Juan de Fuca, to the main shipping channels, it potentially has a huge impact, not only on our shorelines if there's a spill, but on the marine life. And there are people who are studying the relative impact that this would have on our dwindling orca populations, the salmon populations, the herring populations, all of that web of life in our great Salish Sea that really depends upon the waters being preserved.
Now, how many of these ships would actually be passing through the Admiralty Inlet? Do we have an estimate on that?
Yeah, I don't have the exact number on that, but
but certainly one of the routes is right through here.
Yes, one of the routes is through there, but then there's also a considerable amount of traffic going around all of the San Juan avenues and coming down along Whidbey Island. I mean, an oil spill with an incoming tide, the quantity of oil that would need to be contained, you know, it's just sheer pipe dream to think that it could all be contained and kept off of the shores.
So what's happening on December 5th? You were telling me about something.
On December 5th, we're going to be having a follow-up meeting to people who have expressed an interest in either a coal train or oil train or Keystone XL pipeline issues. And it's been sort of a waiting game. I think the Obama administration has wanted to wait until after the elections before making a decision. And there's this thought that if we wait long enough, the people will get tired of being ready to take action. So we're going to get together at noon at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, those people who've been through the training. And I might add there are UUs who were part of it. They're Quakers. They're people from other religious groups or none that attended. This was not just a UU event. And we're going to sit down and say, okay, where are we in terms of our readiness and what we're interested in? And what can we do in the meantime? At this forum in Seattle, which was very well attended, I asked, did the panel of six people think that it was time for peaceful civil disobedience in protest some of these decisions? And they immediately said, we embrace all kinds of action on this because it's going to take everything. It's going to take not only focusing on the big one, but we also have to do everything we can for every little thing because the hearings on many of these are local hearings by local port authorities. And so they said, we can't just focus on one thing. We've got to do it all.
This is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News.
Most of us have seen food trucks, and at some point in your life, you've probably bought a hot dog, sandwich, or snow cone out of one. But how about walking up to a truck to buy the latest in fashion apparel? That's the concept that captured Rosie Itty of Port Townsend. She's launched a business called The Clothes Closet, which specializes in trendy fashions for young women, and she sells them out of her truck. We decided to explore this development because most people in these parts might only know Rosie Itty as vice president of the Port Townsend Main Street program, or because her family owns and operates the Kularb Thai Food Restaurant on Adams Street. But did you also know?
I also own Closet Space, which is a mobile retail clothing store. I'm normally based out of a truck, so imagine a food truck, but instead of food, I sell clothes. And I sell around town. I also sell out in Seattle at festivals and events. But for the winter months, for November and December, I'm here actually in doing a winter pop-up shop, which is a temporary pop-up store. So I'm only in a store for 2 months, closed doors where it's a little bit warmer.
Now, this is a fascinating idea to me, this mobile retail. And it sounds like it's something fresh and new and unique, but it's not, is it? Tell us about the background.
It started out, I want to say, in LA. It kind of popped up down there. You know, the weather's warmer. It's something that you can do all year round. But it's grown to now we have over 100 in the nation. And we actually have an American Mobile Retail Association where, similar to a chamber of commerce, but it's, you know, it's nationwide and it's strictly for mobile retail businesses. So there are pet store trucks out there. There are trucks that sell bath products. There are beauty salon trucks. It's all retailers, small business retailers doing business out of a moving vehicle.
Would this not include the food trucks that you see everywhere?
Food trucks have their own association, actually, so it's separate. We've kept it separate for that reason because there are also so many food trucks. And we do business differently also because we're selling merchandise, you know, rather than food.
Are there any other people in this area doing what you're doing?
Yeah, there's on the West Coast right now, there are three different chapters. So I myself started the Pacific Northwest chapter. So that includes six of us here. And we are all in the Seattle surrounding area as well as Spokane. And, you know, LA, we have over 20. In Northern California is the other chapter. There are also close to 20 mobile retail businesses doing the same sort of thing. Yeah.
Why is this a good business plan for you, for your service, as opposed to having a storefront?
For me personally, it's a lot lower overhead, a lot lower startup costs. Also, what really helps me is that with this pop-up store here in Port Townsend is that people are visiting me at the Fremont Sunday Market, at the different, you know, food truck festivals over in Seattle. And then they're asking me where I'm based out of or if I have a brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. So having one here in Port Townsend is great because it's bringing people to town also. And it's people are seeking me out. And, you know, I've been doing this for over a year now. So it's really built a following from social media, we've gotten a lot of great press in Seattle and actually nationwide, you know, press also. So it's really great because I go to these events and it's just like any other business doing, you know, art festival events around town or in Seattle. You know, Daily Bird Pottery, they sell at the Ballard Farmers Market too. You know, you're going out and you're finding your market and you're actually actively seeking your market out because you're mobile.
Describe, if you would, the process. Are you selling out of the back of a truck, literally, or do you transport your goods and then set up a table? How does this work?
I'm selling out of a truck. So it's, you know, if you walk up, there are stairs that come out the end of it. You walk right up. So it's like a boutique on wheels.
Oh, okay.
And so it's all in there. My truck is a little bit smaller. So it's like your own personal walk-in closet, hence the name Closet Space. And so you go inside and it's just, there's racks all set up and I, you know, use Square as my, you know, credit card processing. I can check out right there on my iPad. And I normally actually have a pop-up changing room outside when it's a little bit warmer, of course, because it's too chilly for that now. But it's a little pink tent that people can, you know, kind of try on clothes in. And yeah.
And now for the winter, you have a temporary brick and mortar. Tell us about that. And what's the term you used for that?
Pop-up shop.
A
winter pop-up shop. I've been calling it my winter shop just to not confuse people. But yeah, and so it's really great because I'm able to see what it's like to be inside a brick and mortar. And it's a really great space in the Kuhn building. It's where Seems to Last used to be and PT, the sweet shop, right next to Public House. And it's great. I'm able to just unload my racks and have a spot where people can find me locally and just for the holidays and to do their shopping. You know, it gets hard when people are always having to look up online where I'm going to be with the truck or where I'm parked, because I can't necessarily be in two places at once with the truck. So I'm still doing the truck for holiday events in Seattle also. So with this, I'm able to do two things at the same time.
You anticipated my next question, which is how you decide where you're going to be. Obviously, there'll be some events where you decide that's a good place. There will be people already there.
Yeah.
What other choices do you make as far as how do you make your other choices in terms of where to go with your truck to sell?
Honestly, in the beginning, it was all trial and error. It was like in the beginning when I first started it, and it was just there was just three of us in Seattle doing this, you know, having a mobile retail business. And it was really new still at the time, and people didn't really grasp onto it quickly. It was basically we would park anywhere anybody wanted us to park. You know, we really tried our hardest to find markets to park at. And I think our biggest thing was when we started parking at the Fremont Sunday Market, that kind of opened doors to more events and more places to park. And now I actually get inquiries all the time, emails of, you know, can you come park at my salon for we're doing this holiday event? Or I've actually parked at the McCord base out in Tacoma for they were doing a military family event. So I've done different events and I've kind of tried them all out to see what works best for me. So I've gotten to a point where I know which events I figure will do well and some that just I would be better if I passed on. So it's really trial and error. You just have to kind of figure it out. I base a lot of my decisions on just marketing. So like if I think that a certain event is going to be similar to the Fremont Sunday Market, the same kind of people shopping, then I'll do it because I know that I do well at the Fremont Sunday Market. Or, you know, I always do well with salons. I parked here in town in Port Townsend where the veterinary clinic is and Sheer Perfection Salon across from San Juan Taqueria. In that little lot, I would do that once a month. And that always did really well for me. And I've done pop-ups inside salons here in town, too, before I had my truck. So I'd unload everything in the salon. I've done it at Salon DeLuca. I've done it at Studio Rue Salon. So I always know that salons and clothes pair very well together.
What sort of clothing do you sell? Do you target a certain market?
Initially, when I started, I decided to buy for young contemporary. So I was aiming to fill that niche for younger clothing here in town. But that's honestly not the case. I mean, I honestly get customers from the ages of 14 to in their 60s. So it's really, really broad. I mean, I buy more affordable young contemporary clothing, just fresher clothes. It's all really trendy things. All of my product moves fairly quickly because it's a lower price point also. So imagine a fast fashion retailer like Forever 21 or like H&M, but I don't do that. I'm a smaller business, so I do my own thing. It's more unique and it's better quality, but that's kind of where I'm aiming. I have started selling a little bit of menswear too, and that's kind of growing also.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing this mobile business how long?
I started not this past summer, but the summer before. And before that, I started Closet Space just as a pop-up business and selling online also. But I launched my truck last July. And yeah.
And how's it going? How's business?
It's going really well. You know, the summertime, I have events every week. And every weekend, there's always something over in Seattle or if it's in town. And I always parked my truck out for that. I parked my truck out for two girls' night outs here in Port Townsend already. I also do home parties, which home parties are really great for the cold winter months because you literally roll up and park outside of somebody's home and they book these special parties, kind of like imagine like a Tupperware party. But I drive my truck over there and I park outside and the ladies shop inside and they have a fun girls' night or, you know, whatever event that they're doing, and they can do a little shopping at the same time. It's really great. I really like having a permanent spot here in Port Townsend, though, and I think that's really the end goal, is to have a permanent brick and mortar in Port Townsend and do my truck events in Seattle and continue to bring more business to town.
So how you see it playing out eventually is that you will be doing both.
Yes, both.
Have a store and have a mobile outlet.
Exactly, yeah. Have both to be able to do both.
With Rosie Itty, Port Townsend's mobile clothing retailer, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Dave Cunningham and Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.